Mark Klopfenstein, you are our treasurer. Do you have a treasurer's report? Why don't you stand up, give us a treasurer's report. Actually, one of the treasurer's report.
We're out of money.
All right, Mark will be standing at the door, gifts for himself and gifts for the church. So, well, congratulations. It's good news. All right. Well, today we continue on in our series on the ethics of love, looking at moral absolutes and how to make the right choices. When faced with situations where love encounters a conflict, what we call moral dilemmas, we noted that there are basically four different ethical systems that Christians have relied on, or at least tried to rely on to give them guidance in such circumstances. We spoke about unqualified absolutism, where that says that there are no true conflicts, so there's always a third alternative. And we also looked at qualified absolutism, that there are times when to obey one of God's commands requires the breaking of another, but these situations are specifically spelled out in the Bible. Then there's something called conflicting absolutism, where you basically choose the lesser of two evils and then you ask for forgiveness. And then graded absolutism, where God's commands exist on different levels of importance and choose the one that is the most loving. Of these four, by far, the last one, also known as the higher laws ethic, enjoys the most scriptural support. As we saw the last time, it is the ethic that Jesus employed regarding his conflicts with the Sabbath day. It is the one that his teaching on the two greatest commandments rests upon. This ethic explains the decisions made by many of the saints in both the Old and New Testaments who faced moral dilemmas. According to this position, all of God's commands are important and must be obeyed. However, some have more weight than others. And when one must choose between the two, he should choose the one that is will do the most good, the one that is the most important. And in so doing, he has done the right thing and will not be guilty of sin. And this is simply illustrated by the law of flight over the law of gravity. A lot of illustrations, but this one serves well. When an airplane lifts off the ground, it does not rebel against gravity or break the law of gravity. It simply overpowers it. And when Jesus healed on the Sabbath, he did not rebel against the Sabbath. He simply pursued a higher priority, that of showing mercy to someone in need, the higher priority of love. Now, if you're not sure about all this and you were not here the last time, which would have been a couple weeks ago, then I encourage you to pick up the CD, get the handout and go through it where the case is actually spelled out in more detail. I ended that sermon with some comments about the need to guard against abuse, because certainly there have been those who have run too far with this sort of thing. And today I want to pick up on that and go over some principles that can be helpful with this very concern, principles by which we can appropriately implement the higher laws ethic. If it is permissible to lie to the Nazi soldiers about where the Jews are hiding in the name of a greater good, then why can't the owner of a business lie to the IRS so as to have extra money to hire more employees? Isn't it good to give people jobs and fuel the economy? Isn't that better than having the government take that tax money and fund Planned Parenthood?
Yeah.
You know, so how do we draw the lines here? Well, admittedly, sometimes it can be a bit tricky to draw those lines. Church history is filled with spirited debates over a number of social issues where the greater good is not always so clear. But many times it is clear, and that is where I want to begin today, laying out a few of the principles that by which we can navigate our way through many of the moral dilemmas that we might face. And you might think of these as ways to resolve conflicts in the most loving way. I have five such principles I want to focus on, all pretty straightforward. There are others that could be added to this list as well. You could probably make a real long list, but the more you add to it, the more they become somewhat debatable and they're subject to a lot of discussion and more than what I want to get into, at least at this time around. The ones that we will be looking at are, again, very basic. They are self-evident and they require very little persuasion, if any. Most of the moral conflicts we face can be addressed by these, and because they are straightforward and self-evident. So let's start with the first one, one we've talked a little bit about already. Obeying God is a higher obligation than obeying man. Abraham's willingness to offer up his son Isaac is a perfect example. Daniel openly praying to God after being ordered not to is another. We see it when Jesus said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. In other words, our love for God must be so much more that our love for others may seem like hate compared to our love for God. And use the illustration of a parent who might command his child to use the Lord's name in vain. Then clearly the child should disobey his parent. But admittedly, such an act of disobedience will no doubt come across as hate to the parent who is being disobeyed. God has placed a number of human authorities over us. We've talked about this in the past. They have been delegated by God and are therefore under God and are not absolute in and of themselves. Their demands are to reflect the law and order of God. And once they conflict with the law and order of God, we must disobey them, whether it be the government, a husband, a parent, a supervisor at work, or a pastor or an elder. Certainly God would never have us commit ourselves to unconditional obedience to any human authority. To do so, as Francis Schaeffer has pointed out, would actually be idolatry. It'd be worship and allegiance to a false god. And we all know the words of Peter and John before the Sanhedrin in the book of Acts, where they said, judge for yourselves whether it is right in God's sight to obey you rather than God. Okay, judge for yourselves. What an expression. Because some things are just self-evident. All right, moving on to number two. Saving innocent life is a higher obligation than telling the truth. I need to spend a little bit of time on this one. There is a difference between lying in order to defraud another person, whether that's in a business transaction, in a courtroom, or just chit-chat with a neighbor, and lying in order to spare an innocent victim from the harmful intentions of an evil oppressor. There are a number of examples of this in the scriptures. Rahab, of course, is probably the most popular. We go back to something I raised the last time. What is the intent of the command to not bear false witness against your neighbor? Well, God wants us to tell the truth to each other because telling the truth is a way that we do unto others as we want them to do unto us. When you buy a car, you want the seller to tell you the truth about its mileage and condition and history. You want the bank to be upfront and tell you all the truth about the loan they are offering you. You want the butcher to tell you the truth about how old that meat is and so on. And you do not want someone lying to you about your daughter's behavior, whether that behavior is good or bad. You want it straight up. You want the truth. Telling the truth is a specific command that rests upon the moral absolute of love. And that moral absolute itself rests upon the nature of God, who himself is love. So it goes back to the central objective of doing what is best for the other person. We expect it from others, and others expect it from us, and God expects it from us as well. Again, the intent of the command to tell the truth is to do good, to serve others, to help others, to treat others justly. It was never intended to be used to further evil, to harm, or to cause the helpless and oppressed suffering or risk their loss of life. And this is why you should tell the Nazi soldiers, for instance, that you don't know where the Jews are hiding. It is why Rahab conjured up the story about the Hebrew spies leaving the city before dark, you know, where she says, and if you hurry up, you might be able to catch them. You know, but the fact is, she had them on the roof the whole time. Both James and the writer of Hebrews refer to her as an example of faith. Again, you know, just kind of like just keep pounding it in here. There is no moral obligation whatsoever to tell the truth to those who intend to use that truth to harm innocent people. And as explained last week, in situations like this, there is no real breaking of God's command here. Rather, a higher law overtakes it, overpowers it, takes priority, just like a magnet overpowers gravity. A higher, more powerful law simply transcends a lower one. All right, let's consider some other examples here. The Hebrew midwives, upon the birth of a baby, as you will remember the story, were ordered to kill all the baby boys, newborn boys. And they would be able, midwives, of course, would be able to do this at the point of birth without anyone else knowing what they were doing. However, the scripture says, quote, they feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Well, the king was furious and confronted them about it. And they lied to him, telling him that the Hebrew women are more vigorous than the Egyptian women and give birth before the midwives could get there. I mean, what a story. No, but he bought it because he doesn't know anything about stuff like this. So, you know, this lie not only spared them from his wrath and probably saved their own lives, but also, more to the point, allowed them to remain in a strategic place of saving even more babies. We also talked about Obadiah, how he successfully hid 100 of the Lord's prophets from the wicked Queen Jezebel. He also supplied them with food and water, and he could not have pulled this off without a good amount of deceit on his part. Now, we read these stories, and, you know, we think it's really cool in Sunday school class when we read this stuff about how Obadiah outfoxed Jezebel. But we need to look under the surface here and consider the implications of stories like this. Norm Geisler refers to a situation involving the captain of a Navy ship captured by North Koreans during the Korean conflict many years ago. When the interrogators threatened to kill his crew of 23 men, the captain actually signed confessions untruthfully admitting to the guilt of spying in North Korean territorial waters. And these false confessions resulted in the crew being spared and eventually released. Geisler argues that in this situation, truth-telling was temporarily suspended but not revoked. An exemption was made in view of a higher obligation to save human lives. Furthermore, in his false confession, one could argue that this captain even served the best interests of the Koreans, sparing them from the act of murder. Consider for a moment the challenges of detectives in trying to get a serial killer off the streets. They need a conviction, but there just isn't quite enough there to fully convince a jury, and they don't want to take the chance. And so, what do? You've seen the TV shows, and it happens in real life. They bring them in. We have witnesses. We have your DNA. We have all the proof we need to send you to the electric chair. But just tell us what happened, and the courts will go easy on you. The greater good of saving other potential victims is served by misleading the killer. Finally, as a very clear example of this principle for anyone who still may be unsure about any of this, let me ask you this, another one of these, judge for yourselves. Who among us would think it wrong, a sin, for a woman about to be raped to lie to her attacker, telling him that she has AIDS? I can't imagine anyone objecting to this. In and of itself, lying is unloving. However, God's directive to tell the truth was intended to be a means of loving and serving others, not of putting people in harm's way. All right, number three, serving people is a higher obligation than preserving things. Loving people is higher than loving things. And it would be hard to find anyone to argue with this. Remember the episode in the Gospel of Mark where four men broke through the roof to bring the paralyzed man to Jesus? I mean, today they'd be arrested for something like that. But, you know, they believed his well-being was more valuable than real estate. And Jesus recognized their persistence and effort in all of this as a great act of faith. That's what he referred to it as, and healed the man. No doubt there was some property damage when Jesus overturned the tables and the cleansing of the temple. And how about all those pigs that ran off the cliff? All because of one little word that Jesus spoke. Who remembers that one little word? Go. Just looks at the pigs and he says, go. All right. We should never place any material thing, any possession or any animal, including the family pet, in higher regard than human life. We should be willing to give up all such possessions to save even one human life. Things are to be used. People are to be loved. People are not a means to an end. Things are. And this is why a neighbor rescuing a drowning child in the swimming pool next door won't be charged with trespassing, even if he did have to climb 3 barbed wire fences and go by 6 signs warning that trespassers will be prosecuted and shot and all that stuff. You know, human life trumps property rights, period. And though there are a lot of opinions about the rightness and wrongness of bombing abortion clinics, we can surely agree that no one should shed any tears when a building that is used to kill human beings suffers property damage. No, everybody gets all upset and outraged over a damaged building, but not what goes on inside that building. The priorities here are all out of whack. All right, now to say that our obligation to people is higher is to admit that the value of people is higher. And this is something that virtually all people of all stripes will agree, that people are more valuable than things. But think about it. Where does that come from? How can we actually say that? Upon what basis can one claim that people are more valuable than things? Well, there is none except this, the one revealed to us in the scriptures. Man has intrinsic worth because man is made in the image of God. Things are temporary and will pass away, but because there is an afterlife, people exist forever. And man was loved by God, supremely loved by God, as seen in the sending of his Son to save us from our sins and in the willingness of the Son to die for those sins. This alone speaks volumes about man's worth. So let there be no question about the pricelessness of human beings, every human being. All right, number 4, saving many persons is a higher obligation than saving a few persons. All things being equal, this would be true. And this one also is fairly obvious, doesn't require a lot of proof. I'll just say a couple things here about it. If one person has intrinsic value, then 2 persons have more and the most persons possible have most value. And this would mean that if one were faced with a decision which involved the possibility of saving either 5 lives or 1 life, then he should save the most lives possible. Common sense here. We see this principle actually reflected in the example of Jesus, God the Son, giving up his own life in order to rescue all of humanity from eternal death. And likewise, in Romans 9, Paul was willing to exchange his one life for the salvation of the Jews. All right, number 5, which opens up several interesting discussions. Helping an innocent victim is a higher obligation than respecting the rights of an evil oppressor. This one has some, as you can see, some overlap with number 2 about telling the truth, but I still think it's worth setting it apart and giving it its own discussion. Not only can it be appropriate to lie to someone motivated by evil to harm others, but it can also be appropriate in certain situations to use force, physical force, to stop them. This is the ethic we rely on to justify self-defense and defending others. To do unto others as you would have them do unto you means that you can't go around hitting people, beating them, shooting them, raping them, or killing them. You can't even push them or slap them. And if you do, then the use of force may become necessary to help protect others from your aggression. We all understand this. We live in a fallen world, and quite frankly, it sometimes gets messy to restrain evil in a fallen world. But evil must be restrained in order to protect the righteous and the innocent. According to Romans 13, this is one of the reasons God has ordained civil authority and the use of the sword. The attacker, in his act of attacking, forfeits his rights to be treated in a civil way. Yet even in this, one must use only the amount of force that is necessary. There is still in this an obligation to the oppressor. For instance, you can't morally justify the shooting of a 12-year-old bully who is in the act of stealing candy from a 9-year-old. I think we all see that. Or blowing up a whole city in order to take out one bad guy. You know, police these days, and I think it's the right decision, are starting to rely more on tasers than lethal weapons, because usually the same job can be achieved with less harm. Though the priority goes to protecting the victim, there is still a moral duty to not harm the oppressor excessively. So, whether we are talking about a nation going to war, a policeman apprehending a criminal, or a private citizen protecting himself or a loved one, there is an obligation to use only the amount of force that is absolutely necessary and no more. Begin with the least level of aggression and proceed from there if necessary. That is, the least level that can be reasonably employed to be effective. You might be able to resolve the situation verbally, using reason, or threats, or even lies. Don't rape me. I have AIDS. If you can, restraining someone is better than knocking them out. If you can, knocking them out is better than causing them permanent damage. And permanent damage is preserved over loss of life. But if in the end, the bottom line here is the taking of a life is the only way to defend yourself or a loved one or another helpless party where their lives are being risked, then so be it. This is the risk the attacker must assume. By going on the attack, he takes the risk of being attacked. Furthermore, as an attacker, he forfeits his right to be treated with equal respect and protection. He is not acting like a human being and cannot be expected to be treated as one when driven by evil. The forfeiting of his rights is in proportion to the severity of his offense. This is why the Bible speaks of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Use deadly force to stop a murderer, but you can't use deadly force to stop someone involved in shoplifting. I think we all understand that. All right, now some Christians argue that Jesus prohibited the use of force even in self-defense, and they refer to his Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says in Matthew 5:39, "But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also," which suggests that Jesus advocated absolute pacifism in all situations. A couple of years ago, Denny took us through this verse and showed that Jesus is actually addressing the issue of being insulted, not the issue of being attacked. So just to refresh your memories here, let's work through it. If someone is attacking you, it is highly unlikely that you would be hit on the right side of your face. Since most people are right-handed, a right-handed punch would land on what side of your face? On your left side. So all this doesn't add up. Unless the hit is that of a backhand, which would be an insult. Okay, and here the right hand would hit on the right side. And certainly the Christian's willingness to be insulted is one we find throughout the New Testament. But nowhere do we see a willingness to be attacked or a willingness to stand by and watch others be attacked. The fact that the sword is endorsed in Romans 13 as a means of maintaining social order shows that God approves of force, even deadly force, in order to punish the wicked and protect the righteous. We also see an endorsement of self-defense and the right to protect fellow comrades when Jesus told his disciples to take their sword, and if they didn't have one, to go get one, even if you have to sell your cloak. In other words, if you have to run around in your T-shirts, but get a sword. And obviously not to go to war, but for self-defense. All right. Moving on to another point in all of this, there is also another factor that must be considered. Not only must the use of force be reasonable, that is, not excessive, there also has to be some reasonable expectation that it will be effective. If a madman, again, this is common sense stuff, if a madman armed with an automatic machine gun is going berserk, shooting everyone in a crowd of people, and you are not armed, run and hide, okay? Don't go up and try to talk him out of it. Don't walk up with a stick in your hand thinking that you can knock the weapon out of his hand. There has to be some reasonable expectation that your action will be successful. It is your moral duty to be responsible and not reckless, even with your own life. All right, now as you can see here, it would take weeks to exhaust all the side arguments and trails that all these issues could lead into. I just know once we say the amen today, I'm going to have 12 people come up and say, what about this and what about that? There's no way to really address all the what about this kinds of questions. The key here is, all things being equal, one is morally obligated to do this or that. I'm not really giving the final word today, just giving us some principles and guidelines to help us work through the material. But there is one what about this question that a few weeks ago I promised to address, and I want to tackle that one this morning. And it should serve as a working example of how we might apply some of these ethical principles and see them all worked out and applied. And the question I want to finish up today is this, and it's really weird for Palm Sunday, but I just want to use it as a test case. The question is, can killing an abortionist be morally justified? All right, you ready for this discussion? Here we go. Some of you are looking at me like you're really nervous. Here we go. You may remember a few weeks ago I talked about being involved in a two-day discussion about all of this with other pro-life leaders back in 1992 in Melbourne, Florida. Good points were made on both sides. Unfortunately, when it was all said and done, there was not a consensus on the question. The issue was not should we engage in this as a strategy. No one was saying that, but rather when these things happened, and they were back then, should we condemn them? Those who said we should not raised a very valid point. We believe in the use of deadly force to stop a killer. Therefore, if we truly believe the unborn child is a person, then it follows that we must support the right to use deadly force to protect them. Otherwise, what are we saying about their personal worth? The other side presented three different arguments. There were those who were concerned that this would hurt the pro-life movement, that ultimately the goal is to win the hearts and minds of people who will certainly be turned away if killing abortionists is something pro-life groups do not condemn. The public relations is a valid one, certainly, but it is basically an argument about strategy, not ethics. Another argument centered on one phrase, which became more like a soundbite: death is never the solution. We are pro-life. To be pro-life means that we oppose death. How can we use death to accomplish our goal? This argument sounded good, but to be honest, I thought it lacked consistency with what we see in the scriptures. In order to stop the advancement of evil, as in the killing of innocent people, evil men were put to death in the Bible. Ahab, Jezebel, Haman, Athalia, Goliath, Korah, Sennacherib, and on. So it seems that death could be a solution after all. Keep in mind I'm talking about a fallen world here. Finally, there were those who argued that we are to love our enemies, not kill them. And this is more of an emotional appeal, but it too lacked real ethical substance. It's a nice slogan for a bumper sticker, but it doesn't really settle the question. As stated earlier, one cannot love an evil oppressor at the expense of hating, as in refusing to help, his innocent victim. So please do not, just going to go on record here, please do not, in the name of Christian love, smile and wish the child molester a good day as he grabs my grandson in the park. Right. The question here is not if we will love, but how we will love. Now, none of these arguments address what I consider to be the pivot point, the pivotal point. If an unborn child is human, as we claim, then why can't they enjoy the same level of protection we allow for other humans? That has to be resolved. So eventually, after wrestling through this question myself for a couple more months, I settled on what I thought was a satisfying answer. And I shared it at one of our rallies back then. I want to give you kind of the 5 to 10 minute version of it today. And if nothing else, it serves as an example of how to apply some of these principles we've been talking about. So I'll let you decide whether my conclusion is solid or not. And I don't have any room there on you. I didn't make any provision on your handouts, because I didn't want you to read ahead. But I do have, if you're interested afterwards, I got a word for word, the whole bit here, if you're interested. Okay, here we go. First, I cannot dispute the argument that if we believe in the use of deadly force to stop a killer, then we must support the right to use deadly force to protect the unborn baby. To deny them equal protection is to deny them equal personhood. There's no way around that. And so I concluded that it is morally justified to use deadly force to protect an unborn child. But it does not necessarily follow that one is morally justified to use deadly force to stop an abortionist. And that is where most people make the mistake. They jump from one conclusion to the next and without giving it a second thought. Using deadly force to protect an unborn baby is not the same thing as using deadly force to stop an abortionist. These are two different statements, and the difference must be highlighted and exposed. It is a big one, and it sheds a lot of light on the question at hand. Killing an abortionist fails to meet two critical conditions that are necessary for the act to be regarded as justifiable. Conditions we've already talked about this morning. The first is this. Justice, and for that matter, love, forbids using more force than what is reasonably necessary. If I can stop an evil aggressor in any other way than by killing him, then I have a moral obligation to do so, within reason. Using deadly force to stop an abortion provider is an excessive use of force because there are other options besides the one of taking his life. For instance, just for the sake of the argument here, the abortionist could be kidnapped or disabled. His hands could be injured or damaged in a way that would prevent him from killing babies. And as grisly as it sounds, it is certainly a better option than taking his life. Better yet, since we have a higher obligation to people than to things, even to evil people, destroying the equipment used in the abortion would basically produce the same result, at least temporarily, or even destroying the building itself. The point is, taking a human life is the last resort, and there are other alternatives here, and we are to use the least level of aggression necessary. Therefore, deadly force cannot be justified in this case because it is excessive. All right? But there's more. That alone should make the case, but killing an abortionist also fails to meet a second condition that is absolutely essential for the act to be regarded as justifiable. Not only is it excessive, but it is also ineffective. You cannot justify killing someone unless there is some reasonable expectation that the victim is going to be saved. The person who is in control of the baby's fate is not the abortionist. He is simply a hired hitman, so to speak. The key person here is who? The mother, or in some cases, the father of the child, or even the parents of the mother. But regardless of who all is involved in the decision, if she is absolutely set on killing the baby will be killed. Shooting an abortionist, or for that matter, kidnapping him, or cutting off his fingers, or blowing up his clinic, or other similar aggressive physical acts cannot be justified since there is no reasonable expectation that such acts will save any baby. The mother will just go elsewhere for the abortion. And so how does one stop the mother? Shoot her? Well, the baby dies. Perhaps an argument could be made for kidnapping her, then holding her in captivity until she gives birth, then taking the baby, then letting her go, you know. But you certainly can't justify killing anyone or even causing anyone permanent physical damage. So, though philosophically we could say that one is morally justified to use deadly force to protect an unborn child, we would also have to say that there is no feasible situation where that can actually be applied. How will any killing of any person save any unborn child? So basically, we are left with the same tactics that we have been employing for 35 years now. Since the mother is the key, we need to employ all these different ways of trying to persuade her, trying to influence her, and trying to persuade all who could be involved in such a decision one day. Education, sidewalk counseling, masses of people standing in front of the clinic as we're planning on April 26th, prayer and fasting, TV commercials, crisis pregnancy centers, billboards. Certainly laws that prevent or severely restrict abortion are also effective tools of persuasion. And ultimately, that's where we really do need to win that battle for that. That is the best solution overall. And so forth. But the point is, a pregnant mom isn't going to be persuaded to give life to her baby because someone guns down an abortionist. It's just that clear. So it comes down to this. The use of deadly force cannot be justified if there are other options available. And furthermore, it cannot be justified unless there is a reasonable expectation of actually saving the victim. And killing an abortionist fails on both conditions. All right. Now, some of this material here is actually a good lead in for other subjects that I'm eager to share. For instance, the whole matter of war and something called the just war theory. And I'd also like to cover a few things on civil disobedience itself and look at degrees of activism and what is appropriate when faced with a government policy that is oppressive. Some nations, countries already are facing churches are facing criminal prosecution if they speak out against homosexuality. Hopefully we will never face that here, but we kind of need to get ahead of the game, and as the culture becomes more hostile to Christianity, we need to be a little bit prepared on how we're going to handle some of these things. All of this is part of implementing the higher law's ethic. When we face moral dilemmas, what really is our obligation on this situation or that situation? Next week is, as you know, Resurrection Sunday, and probably not the best time to discuss these kinds of subjects, so we will pick it up the Sunday after that. And then on that Sunday, we will conclude this segment on the ethic of love. From there, we will start in on the application of love, love in the home, love in the workplace, love in the church, even loving those who make your life miserable and so on. We'll start talking about more of those nuts and bolts kinds of things now that we've been working for some time on a lot of the theories and the theology behind all of it. Okay? Anyone going to quit the church because of what I said this morning? All right. Danny, would you come and close?
I hope you've all thoughtfully looked at this material that Wendell's presented over the last few weeks. It's a sort of approach that you don't hear too often in certainly in Sunday morning churches, if you hear it in church at all. But it's very important that we consider these positions, these nuances of understanding the biblical text before we actually are confronted with that sort of ethical dilemma. The time to make those choices is, or the time to get the foundation ahead of time so that you can make those choices when the pinch comes. You can't think clearly when you're in a crisis situation, and it's important that you have these principles worked out. And I hope you see the persuasive biblical material for the graded absolutism. It's not always been the most popular position within evangelicalism. Those of you who can remember back to 20, 30 years ago, there was more of a denial that ethical norms ever come in conflict. And in fact, in a fallen world, they do. So it's important to give this some thought, to consider it, and not just leave today and say, okay, that was an interesting service, and what's next? It's important that we integrate our understanding of the knowledge of the Bible with our understanding of our ethical principles and work it out and be thoughtful on it instead of just shooting blank. So blessings to you all this week, and we'll see you next week, or Friday probably. So you're dismissed.